CFRC.ca was made possible through the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada and our amazing Funding Drive donors. Thank you so much.
And good afternoon. It is 4 o'clock, I think almost right on the dot. Thanks for tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located here in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. This is Finding a Voice, spoken word program airing here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. And we do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And coming up on the show today, you're going to hear, from a May 4th a launch and reading event at Novel Idea Bookstore. You're going to hear with touring poet John Wall Barger with his latest collection, Resurrection Pie, and local poets Liz Huntley Jens and Callista Markotic. And you're going to hear them in both conversation and their readings as well. This will run several minutes into the second hour, and I will run it. I'll air it uninterrupted, so I won't break with just a few minutes left. And in the second hour, and then following that launch from an April 9th book launch at, again, Novel Idea Bookstore, you'll hear Molly Cronin launching her new book of comics called Future Me is Fat. And what you will hear is a conversation between her and Nalina Velji, a PhD student in gender studies at Queen's University. And just to start off with my usual start of the hour announcement, occasionally some poetry, spoken word, or music played on this show may contain strong language, but I try to air it in its entirety with content unedited to honor the integrity of the creative integrity of both the author and the piece. And let's go ahead, and again, this will run a few minutes, maybe even as many as 10 or so past the top of the hour. You're going to hear from a May 4th, again, launch and reading event at Novel Idea with touring poet John Wall Barger and his latest collection, Resurrection Pie, in conversation and discussion and readings with local poets Liz Huntley Jensk and Callista Markotic. And let's go ahead and just see if this is going to work. Here we go.
I think we'll start. We'll start the proceedings. Thank you very much for coming. It's really good to see everybody here. It's a pleasure. And it's my pleasure to introduce John Barger, John Wall Barger. That's how I was introduced to him. And I asked him if he likes to always have the wall there, and he said not necessarily, so I think it's optional. we're going to do it this way. I'm going to introduce John, and then he's going to read for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then I'm going to introduce Liz, and she'll read that way too. And then I'm just going to read two poems, short poems, but before I read them, I'm going to try to tell you how they were influenced by this gentleman here, because he was my editor for my book that came from Frontenac House, where he's a contract editor. And I think you will be impressed how much he helped my poems evolve into something that belonged in a book. And then he'll finish with some other reading. I think a special poem at the end. It's kind of a long poem, you said, but I mean, not long, long, but longer than some of his other poems. So welcome, and about John's bio, it's really, you know, interesting that John, he's a very generous, open-hearted person in his poetry, but he's very sparse in his official bio. It's really short. Like, I can show it to you on here, and he didn't give me any more than that, a little bit there, and yet this is what everyone else had to say about him, so he's not one to really pump up his bio too much, but I'll read it to you. John Wall Barger is the author of 7 books of poems and a collection of essays. His latest book of poems, Resurrection Pie, just came out with LSU Press. He's a contract editor for Frontenac House, lives in Vermont, and lectures in the writing program at Dartmouth College, which is just across his border in New Hampshire. That's all he says here. But I could add volumes about his erudition in poetry and literature and his gracious good nature and good humor and his prowess as a teacher and an editor. But for now, I'll merely add that John, though born in the USA, did a lot of his growing up in Canada, has lived on both coasts. He lived in Halifax, spent his formative years there, and lived in Vancouver as well. And I think, and we can claim him, he's also a Canadian, but even if he didn't have that citizenship, his poem, one of his poems, a poem from this book, titled differently, is in this year's Best Canadian Poetry. So I would say that verifies his Canadian citizenship. So now he's going to read to you from his new book.
Thank you, Cal. Can you hear me at the back?
Yeah.
Yay. Okay. So I'm going to start by reading a poem that's maybe a tiny bit experimental. So I'll just try to give a little bit of an introduction to it. I had a friend who died, was hit by a drunk driver 10 years ago. And she was from Halifax. And she died in Ontario, in Hamilton, Ontario. And I struggled with how to write a poem about this and not to diminish it and not to turn it into an anecdote. And so it took me a few years to find something. And finally, what I've done is I told the story in reverse. So this is a poem that moves backwards. And it came partly from, in Slaughterhouse-Five, Kurt Vonnegut has got a little paragraph, some of you might remember, that talks about war, and war in reverse is something kind of nice. It's like a love story. So all the bombs that hit the ground go back up into the plains, and the plains go back to the countries where they belong, and the soldiers become children. You know, it's kind of a nice story in reverse. So this is a story, it's called Resurrection Walk, and it moves from the present. I was living in Philadelphia at the time, and I walk backwards, kind of figuratively speaking, to Canada. And the person who died is named Zoe. Resurrection Walk. I'm walking, almost skipping, up Sansom, past the Noshery. Suddenly this broad moon of a face, brown hair, freckles, hard beauty. So I stop, step back, backward, slow at first, a few steps not to trip, then briskly back, back, toward the bridge, up the Schuylkill River. Back I step, along the highway, toe, heel, always backward, shoulder of the road. Vehicles hissing by, sports car, minivan, transport truck. Hours pass, days, weeks, sun rising west, setting east. I see, wrong way around, to what's behind, what's gone. Roadkill, twisting in a blood sun hat, toward a pickup truck. Then it pops up, the skunk, trotting backward into a grove. Summer folds into spring, spring to winter. Flowers shrink, green wanes. Kids put on sweaters, mufflers, hoods. Old folks pick up speed. I walk on, back, back, toe, heel, toe, heel. My grandma hops out of her wheelchair, walks unaided backward into her inward apartment, waving, hello, hello. A sheet is lifted from Matthew's body, his face convulsing, frowning. He flips me the bird, leaps backward into his painting studio. A box is lifted out of the ground, lid removed. Zoe is hoisted into a black car that backs away to the morgue. ICU, bed. Zoe chokes awake. Eyelids twitch, fingers shiver. Lifted onto a gurney and backed out of the hospital into an ambulance, to a park, lowered onto the street in a heap from which she springs, suddenly uncoiling into the air, spiraling, road-gashed toward a Toyota, wounds closing, her moth-wing ribcage against the windshield, and Zoe rises, backward, smoothly onto her feet, into a rhythmic run, evening sun climbing, Toyota speeding in reverse through the broken fence away from Zoe, who jogs back up the stairs, toe, 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 freckles, nose ring, earbuds. The Toyota swerves backward out of the park to a pub, spits a man onto a stool, vomiting drink after drink out of his stomach into a glass. I've been on this little tour. I went down the United States coast, the East Coast, and then now I'm really excited to be in Canada. The name of the book is Resurrection Pie, and maybe a few of you know that this is a word that's in the dictionary, or a phrase that's in the dictionary. It means basically leftovers. So like a farmer's table, like pre-refrigeration, they would have a big meal, and then the next day, they make a pie out of it. They put a crust on the top, and they serve it as a pie. And this is resurrection pie, it's called. And I have the very interesting experience of having people introduce my book. And for those of you who have written books, it's sometimes hard for us to put names on it. You know, like we write this thing and maybe a kind of vibe holds it together, but we're not exactly sure how to articulate that. So what I'm hearing people describe, I don't think Cal said this in her generous introduction, but they're saying that this is a surrealist book. And surrealism is an interesting word, isn't it? Because sometimes it just means something weird or something that you want to kind of discount. Yeah? So that's so surreal. Like, forget about it. To me, I'll try to just say very briefly the kind of surreality that I'm interested in is, like, I don't know if anybody knows Yorgos Lanthimos, the film director, Begonia, and his early stuff like Dogtooth. I see a few heads nodding. Or David Lynch, even, who I absolutely love. But, like, there's a kind of surrealism, maybe Buñuel at times, there's a kind of surrealism in film where you enter and there's a world that you're seeing, and you think it's your world or our world, and then slowly you realize, oh, this has got some different properties than our world. This family is not behaving normally, or, you know, the sets of principles are just somehow a little bit different. And then it doesn't explain to you how, but there's a certain tension there, yeah? So this is kind of what I'm interested in, perhaps, in the kind of surreality that I'm writing, like little parables. So this one is called The Saboteurs, and the principle that's a little different than our world is that this describes a city where there are bombs placed around the city, and nobody knows why they are there. And it's called The Saboteurs, but they can't find any of the saboteurs. Like, who are these saboteurs? It's kind of a prose poem. Soon we didn't even hear the explosions. We strolled past each new crater as if it had always been there. Nobody knew the saboteur's agenda. No demands, no manifesto. Explosions were green. How, barked a general, do they make them green? Their targets seemed indiscriminate. Hospital, lake, bank, parking lot, forest. And they, the saboteurs, seemed invisible, trackless. Explosions just happened. Now and then a drunk or a child voiced what we'd all been thinking, that maybe somehow our city had been lined with bombs before any of us were born, that there were no saboteurs. By dumb luck, we captured one, green-eyed, calm, unremarkable. We starved and stretched him, thumbscrewed him, ground his face against our maps, demanding names, plans, dates, anything. He was the gentlest man I'd ever met. He kept blessing us and our families. We wept as we hurt him. To each other, we called him Francis. In a circle among us, his torturers, Francis said, "I am sorry, I do not understand your questions, but aren't the bombs sublime?" "How?" we asked sincerely. He just smiled. We received orders, drove Francis to a field. He bowed to us in the grass. Felix drew the short straw, but Felix, instead of executing Francis, offered his gun. We all offered Francis our guns. We left him there and drove back to our decimated city unarmed. Thank you for those little appreciative sounds.
he was drinking those up.
Cal was nice enough. I wasn't sure I was going to read this one, but Cal was nice enough to mention a poem that Mary Dalton generously included in the Best Canadian. So I'll read that one. It's called No Longer Invited to Dinner. And brief context, do you guys know the Darwin Award?
Yes.
It's kind of, I'm not really in love with the Darwin Award. It's given, it's a couple of folks online who have nothing better to do, or I don't know who they are, but it's given to people who die in a less than smart way. Maybe they tried to hug a grizzly bear or something like this, or touch a wild elephant or something, and then they end up dying. And the idea is that, you know, yay, they didn't propagate the species. It's not a nice thing, but there's interesting stories there. And as poets, we can talk about this after if you guys agree with this or not, but I think as poets, it's our job to be empathetic and to try to, you know, see people's psychology, you know, and to empathize with them rather than to just project this kind of lens onto people. So this is called No Longer Invited to Dinner for the winners of the 2014 Darwin Award. And these are, I'll say very quickly, Anastasia and Miguel. It was in Russia. They were on the sixth floor of a balcony. They kind of escaped from a party and started making out on the balcony, and they fell and died. Let us celebrate you, Anastasia and Miguel, copulating on a balcony, falling six stories. From birth, we advised, keep your things close, do not share. It's yours, all yours. We were fools. Perhaps now you are rocks falling into an abyss for 100 years. Does it matter? Now all you had is impounded, as if it were never yours. Even the memories, even the last, his erection in the dark, even your unpaid parking tickets, even those crates of unread books in your parents' attic, even the possum in your garden you never mentioned to anyone. We're all teenagers, stoned, horny, stepping out of the party. Praise us all. Cut loose our strings. We told you we were the teachers, this the class. It's all for the good, we said, hoping you would make it so. Now, look what happened. You're no longer invited to dinner. Even the good feeling, you became the wall around. Miguel hoisted Anastasia onto the railing. Anastasia unzipped him. Let us giggle with them. Let us make love to the air, like a Godard jump cut, a trick of bad editing. That sound? A phone ringing. Yes, it sounds close. It's not. I'm going to read two more. One of them is called, the first one is called Self-Harm Song. Once, on the afternoon we met, a woman showed me her upper thigh. Deep red rivers ran across it. She lives, she explained, in the black stream beneath perfection. What, she said, cut, if not yourself, such a release. It just feels right. Some of us barber ourselves, as show mice do, nipping our fur till it peels off like a hay roof in a hurricane. Some caged birds pluck their feathers, mutilate their skin. You sense, as the knife sinks in, the ancient laughter, howl of outrage, pulse beat of the world. It hurts, but is honest. Sid Vicious knew it. Eunuch priests, too, self-flagellating on the day of blood, dies sanguinis, eyes rolling in fever dream parodies of Christ. Oh, self-harm goddess, part phoenix, chained and flaming, your touch a cataclysm, your heart a crucifixion, chimera of humiliation, release us. She responds, daughters, sons, other ones, to crack the egg of the hidden island, turn your shame inward. So that's what we tell our fledglings with every wink and poke. We can't soothe them or ourselves. Instead, we, laughing, waving, thumbs up, trot you out of doors in bright dresses and iron shirts into the sunlight alone. I had a bandy-legged dog. She got so distraught when I went out, she licked her paw to the bone. She meant no harm. It was just love she didn't know where to put. I'm going to read one more in this first little section. Rage flowers. Poor, miserable Lewis sat on my couch all afternoon, head in his hands, crying about his girlfriend, Little Pumpkin, how she'd stolen his Ford Pinto and left him. Lewis, bisected by evening light, angling from the window on his left, was furious. I never saw him so mad. When did she stop loving me? He blurted out. The madder he got, the more he cried, writhing in his seat, crumpling inward like a burning house. The day, he murmured theatrically, is too long, too slow. I'm stuck in the freezing shadow of the present moment. Nice phrase, I said, jotting it in my notebook. Lewis just kept crying, repeating how old he feels, how scary life will be without Little Pumpkin in it. That's when he started coughing and coughing, his eyes bugging out. I ran to get a glass of water. When I came back, his lap was covered in blood. Not blood, flower petals. I blinked. Lewis was coughing red flower petals onto his shirt, onto my couch. From his lips, the petals drifted. I picked up a handful of the petals, so soft. It was strange, as if I were the first prehistoric creature having the first dream. Lewis didn't seem to notice. He kept repeating how mad he was, now coughing whole flowers, up to his knees in red petals, coughing, coughing. I called 911 and yelled into the phone, "Please come quick. My friend is knee-deep in soft flowers, rising to his neck. It's so beautiful, I don't know what to do." Thanks.
I don't know what I can say, but that's certainly something to digest. It's great. And I want to introduce Liz Huntley. She also gave me a pretty sparse little intro, but she is my friend, a writer, a yoga teacher, and the co-owner of an artisan bakery called Coffee Bar Grains and Goods. No, I read that wrong. Artisan bakery and coffee bar called Grains and Goods. She lives on a hobby farm near Kingston with her husband and three feral boys. Her poems are published in Room, Grain, Riddle Fence, Ark, and elsewhere. And she's just published her first chapbook called A Mother's Pocket Dictionary of Accuracies and Inventions. And she is the inaugural Stephen Hyten Fellow at the L. Purdy A-Frame and Queen's University.
That's cool.
About Liz, I guess I would just like to add that when she reads to the poets at Bruce's open house, I have noticed that everybody's smiles. Everybody always is smiling. They are appreciating her poems about her beautiful, feral boys. And we are all parents at that time, all awestruck and baffled and full of hope and love when Liz reads those poems. So here's Liz.
Thank you. I'm actually going to start with one that Callie requested. She said, read the car seat poem. I think she meant this one. It's not called the car seat poem. It is called Hornworms. There are hornworms lurking amongst the tomato plants, rippling green and fat as my thumb. I'm inclined to kill them when I find them, but my husband captures two in a glass jar with a mesh cover. He's convinced that we can feed them and observe their metamorphosis. Chrysalis to giant mottled moth. A science experiment for the benefit of the kids. We fill the jar with lush stalks of tomato plants and a sturdy branch on which the hornworms might cocoon. They set to eating and pooping at an alarming rate, chomping through leaves as fast as we can replenish them and leaving inches of goopy green droppings in the bottom of the jar. Alas, the hornworms do not love this new environment. After a few days, they burrow into the heaping pile of their own shit and die. This prompts many questions from my 5-year-old. What happens to them next? Where does a hornworm go after it dies? Perhaps they come back as something else, a pair of sisterly cows, a couple of squawking crows? This speculation helps him to deal with the more pressing question of what happens to us after we die. On this, he likes to speculate, too. We'll come back as a family of frogs or a herd of goats. One day, while driving to the grocery store, he imagines we'll come back as car seats. Then we can all drive around together, he says. I don't have the courage to tell him we probably don't come back all together, probably not even as our whole selves. Maybe a bit of his carbon recycled in a grass root, his iron taken up by a fruiting tree, a breathful of his air passed from lung to lung to lung. Maybe his soft heart nestled into the prayer fold of a grasshopper's wings. His soul in the thrumming body of a hummingbird. Maybe even a little of his bone dust gets woven into the fabric of a car seat. He has bigger questions. What came before the first thing? What happens after everything dies, after the sun burns out? I don't know, I tell him. Maybe nothing. Maybe it begins all over again. Maybe we all come back as hornworms in a glass jar. I'm going to read a couple from this little chapbook. And it's kind of it's a dictionary, as the title suggests, about motherhood. I've been peddling it around town quite a bit, so I'm sorry if you've heard so much of it. I'm going to read one that I have not yet read in public, which there are only a few of those left. And it does have a pile of poopy diapers on the cover, so that's just giving you some clues about where we go. G, guilt. Noun. 1, a feeling of having done wrong or failed an obligation. 2, sociologists divide guilt into 3 categories. A, reactionary, feelings of guilt for something you have done. B, anticipatory, feelings of guilt for something you might do. And C, existential, a widespread feeling of not living up to one's potential, making choices against one's core values, or a general awareness of being implicated in universal injustice. 3, parental guilt is a distinct form of guilt encompassing all 3 categories, in which a parent feels guilty for pretty much everything they have done, not done, could not possibly do, anticipate doing, dream of doing, and imagine they have done when they actually didn't, in relationship to their child or children. A, parental guilt is the size and weight of a beached blue whale. B, parental guilt feels like putting your warm tongue to a frozen street lamp and getting it stuck there. C, parental guilt has the yellowish tinge of a jazz bar at 9 a.m. on a Monday morning. D, parental guilt is the sound of a key digging into the side of a 1957 Ferrari 250 Testarossa. E, parental guilt smells like the moldy Tupperware you find under your teenage son's bed 7 months after he's moved out of the house. And then the second one I'll read is N, and it's a special one to me just because it's actually the first one I wrote. I did not start with A, I started with N. And when I wrote this one, I didn't know I was actually going to write a whole dictionary. I just wanted to write this one poem, and then I, quite a bit later, actually went back and made 25 more. So N, nipple, noun, one. The protuberance of a mammary gland upon which in the female the lactiferous ducts open and from which milk is drawn. 2. Observing his mother breastfeeding a baby, a 5-year-old names them nozzles. In private, he presses a stuffed penguin to his flat bosom and wills the milk forth. 3a. From the earlier neble nibble, likely diminutive of neb nib, the pointed tip. Dipped in ink, the nipple marks the page with a definitive period. B. Adjacent to nip, nibble, nubile, and also nebulous, most often shrouded in cloth, the faintest outline may be visible to the eager eye. 4. German, Brustwarze, breast wart, only slightly less unlovely than the moniker favored by pubescent boys, hooter handles. 5a, unneedful of reproductive organs, the gods do not possess them. B, oh, how the butterfly and the bird of paradise envy us these corporeal roses. 6, like a sailboat buoyed by the open sea or the explorer's flag planted at the highest peak, the nipple is a landmark in a lonely expanse of skin. 7, over time the breast sags, but the nipple always rises to the occasion. So, that's that one. And, oh, I was going to read a few more. Can I read a few more? I think I'm here as the foil. As most of you know Callie, and as you've seen, John, they write complex and significant and real deal poems, and I just am here for the, like, poopy diapers and giggles. So along that path, or maybe like very far down that road, here is one more very ridiculous one that I wrote about my kids. And it has an excessively large title. This is a poem about what happens when you meet the person of your dreams, but instead of living happily ever after, you decide to have kids. Pink fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows is a song from an album called Songs to Wear Pants To. It is the most inane song I have ever encountered. The lyrics are literally just pink fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows over and over and over again. Naturally, my pink fluffy kids adore this song and demand to listen to it on repeat. My husband and I are sitting on unicorns, the sofa, trying to dancing, have a conversation on rainbows, but the pink children keep interrupting. My fluffy husband and I are trying unicorns dancing to make a connection, but the rainbows children are getting wilder and wilder. They are jumping, dancing on the pink fluffy sofa. Unicorns, each time they land pink, I feel myself being propelled up, fluffy, away, up and away. On rainbows, my husband, fluffy, is reaching across the void. We are trying to pink this relationship, but we are unicorns apart. Why can't you just rainbows, he shouts. And I want to refract every color in his direction. I want to meet him at the center of this pink, pink, pink arc. I want to tell him that I fluffy, but the unicorns are just too damn loud. Okay, I have one that's kind of a downer, but I'm inspired to read it because we had this event on Saturday just past with some of Kingston's like really great top poets, and they shared a couple of them shared their poems from the Contemporary Verse two-day poem contest. Anyone else do that this year? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you don't know it, it's a contest where they give you 10 words, at least 5 of which you have to look up in a dictionary because they're words that like nobody actually uses. And then you have 48 hours to write a poem using all 10 words. So these like top-notch, really great Kingston poets read a couple of their poems. And like those two poets, I am also just guessing at how to pronounce a couple of these words. So I feel myself to be in very good company in that regard. And this one kind of has like two voices. There's the persona of the poem speaking, and then there's a little interjection of a textbook voice, which on the page they have two different fonts. I will try to use my voice to indicate who is who. Cognitive distortions of a high-functioning depressive. Each morning you crawl out of the hell of your own sleeplessness, black and white thinking. Your need to do it flawlessly or not at all is nearly petrifying, but wallowing in bed is not an option. In chess, they call it Zugzwang. The player must move, but any given move worsens the position. You will have to live this day imperfectly. It comes off as a mere bit of stiffishness. Resting bitch face, your classmates once said. All your energy invested in worrying about what people think of you so that you become deer caught in mind reading. It's not that the cup is half empty, but rather always overflowing emotional reasoning. And everything is your fault. Personalization. You should have been happy as a clam, but something in you unhinged. The one grain of sand that refused to pearl. Mental filter. You can't green your grass on this side of the magnification and minimization. The baseline of this funk, you will never be good enough, never be good enough, never be overgeneralization. 40 years into the game, you can act the dipnosophist, hold court at any dinner party, but you imposter pizzazz. Arrive home convinced that everybody hates you, jumping to conclusions. Pick at the carcass of your life and lick hopelessness from the bone. A solivagant wandering the desolate landscape of your own interior, you take the express train to defeat, pitch your private ululation, catastrophizing, and then paste on a smile. Come now, the day begins and you know how to face the music, though beauty is always somewhere behind you, just out of reach. And the last one I will share is seasonally very appropriate, and also I'm quite proud of this poem. It almost made it into an anthology alongside one of John's poems in the 2026 Best Canadian Poetry Anthology. There is at the very back a little list of notable poems, and if you look carefully, you might need a magnifying glass, but you will find the title of this poem with my name beside it. This one is called Lawnmower. In early May, the lawn lay luxurious about the house, her pelt glossy with dandelions. The breeze gently combed her hair, and she shivered where the bees delivered 1,000 golden kisses. I came full throttle. I was an ungodly shriek in that sea of green. I left her shorn so that the bees hovered at nothing. The neighbors approved. We agreed she must be kept under control. And all that day, up and down the road, the lawns were cut down and tamed until the air was heavy with the scent of the lifeblood of grass. The lilacs remained silent, held their buds tight-lipped, and did not release their fragrance. As evening fell, the tulips, too, curtained their windows and looked away, and the frogs trilled across the pond as though nothing had happened. Only the mice protested and mourned the loss of their tunnels and paths among the tall grasses, though they dared not gather where the nest lay cleaved and bloodied. Who listens to these small voices in the face of such an ordinary violence? It is now my great pleasure to introduce Callie, whose bio is somewhat scarce. Callie is one of our Kingston's best of the best, and also a friend and an inspiration to me. Callista Markotich, retired teacher, principal, and superintendent of education, returned to her desk to write poetry, a lifelong aspiration which she did not expect to realize. Her award-winning poems are found in many Canadian journals and quarterlies and have received Pushcart and National Magazine nominations. She is particularly proud of her chapbook, Edward, finalist in two important 2024 competitions, and her recent poems awarded first and third places in the New Quarterly's 2025 Occasional Verse Contest. Her 2024 collection, Wrap in a Big White Towel, published by Frontenac House, was a finalist in the 2025 Gerald Lampert Memorial First Book Award. She is contributing editor at ARC Poetry. And I will add to that that I don't know why Callie doesn't do the CV2 two-day poem contest, because her vocabulary is astounding, and she's the only person who would not have to look up the words and she'd know how to pronounce them. And she'd probably win, because she wins all the prizes. Thank you, Callie.
Thank you, Liz. Thank you. And I think you see why I said that people at Bruce's open house are always smiling when Liz reads your poem. Okay, I have two very short poems, but I want to, John knows I'm planning to do this. I wanted to try to tell you a little bit about how these poems were influenced by my editor with Frontenac House, John Wall Barger. And because there wasn't, I remember the first time we talked on the phone, we talk generally first. Natalie, you probably know all about this. And then, so I thought this was good, and we were talking. He's so approachable, and it was wonderful. And then we were going to close off that call, but he said that, you know, we'd talk again and go over the poems. And I said, we'll go over the poems. He said, yes, we will go over every single poem, which we did. So I picked two short ones because brevity is one of the things that we talked about. But first, I'd just like to go back. I mentioned something about his erudition, and I was looking up my notes to decide, you know, what to focus on here, because my notes are copious. But almost the first thing I wrote in making notes when we were talking on the phone was the term negative capability. Mm-hmm. And I'm very embarrassed to say I had a question mark after it because I really I had to kind of jettison back to some literature classes from a long time ago, and obviously I didn't pay enough attention when we were talking about Keats. But I think it's interesting now because almost all of the things that I would like to focus on here, three things, They all kind of have a link with that idea of, you know, not having an irritable reaching after fact and reason, or some people will say science and logic. Because the first thing with John was that a poem should connect with the reader, or the listener in this case. And I checked that with my friend Natalie Sorensen here, because she's editing with John right now. I asked her what she thought was probably the main thing that he felt, and she said that. She said connection with the reader or the listener. So, and then the other thing for this poem, it's a very brief poem. And I think the thing there is that that connection is the main thing. So there's a tendency to say much more. You know, there are so many beautiful images that might want to be expressed. There are so many stanzas that you could put about other things, but they're going to just dilute that main connection. So this poem was one that was shortened considerably through my work with John. I had just a little background. Like, it was kind of like, you know, sort of get in to the poem and break the heart and then get out. And so this poem was about walking on the ice, one of those years when it got very cold and the lakes were frozen, but there was no snow. So you could see down to the bottom, and even there was a little bubble down there with this bright green emerald frog in it, and there was a whole stanza about that and stanzas about other things, but it wasn't really about that. And so I was encouraged to make it much shorter and to get to the part that mattered. And just before I read it, I will mention that in the poem before, just preceding it, there's a piece where my sister was telling me on the phone that she had just had a diagnosis where a melanoma had metastasized, mm-hmm. and it was in the lungs, the brain, and maybe the bone. And that was really what was coming up when I was trying to write this poem, but I had all this other stuff about the frog and the crystal and what was on the bottom of the lake and everything like that. So this is how it ended up with the cuts. And also, I think the title was way longer, too, because it's just called Ice. Scritch and scratch of ice picks, drone of a snow machine. My smartphone's ding. It's Jol. In her voice, glee glints through rue. While it's not in the bone, Cal, her laugh, her wry little laugh. It's Mum's laugh. An icy terminus pushes towards me, sun-caught knife edges too brilliant to see. Behind its hiss, There's tumble. Mum and Dad, tumbling, jaw tumbling. And me, phone in hand. Not this phone, though. The other one from before. Black and curved like the arc of a cheek, with coil on coil tethering icy truths together. Mm-hmm. So that was a much longer poem before that. And then also this idea that John was, in order to sort of make this connection, one of the things he mentioned was that he's also a film buff. So in film, as in poetry, you really don't want to leave the reader at sea, not knowing, you know, what is going on at all. So his idea here was a good one, and a practical one in a way, too, that if, you know, if the first few lines are too abstract, if they don't give the reader anything, you might want to have the title do more work, which makes sense, eh? So so we got some good titles out of this. And but this one also speaks to the fact that John is very good at finding epigraphs. I don't know what his sources are, but in his own book here, for instance, he has a couple of wonderful epigraphs. And, you know, I don't, as I say, I don't know where he finds them, but they really work with his poetry. I'll just read one of them. It's it's from Faulkner. It's Sanctuary. The house was full of sounds. They came into her with a quality of awakening, resurgence, as though the house itself had been asleep. It's so suitable for the poems that we read in there. So this poem, it was one of the few poems in here which is really all a metaphor. And so the first lines really were abstract. And I had some title, you know, it was like a kind of a hackneyed title. I think I called it Horse of a Different Color, which is a bit cliche. But it was kind of the idea that if Winston Churchill could call his deep, serious depressions the black dog, that, you know, we might think of depression as being a black horse. And so if that is one of those deadly depressions, you might have a gray horse that is something that is a melancholy, but it's more manageable. So, you know, that's kind of an abstract thing. And the first lines were like that. He didn't tell everybody everything. So John found this somewhere. It's in Old English, and the title is Melancholy Madness. But madness is spelled like, you know, the last part is M-E-S-S-E, like it's Old English. And then there's an epigraph. It says, I judged him to be vexed with a melancholy madness, called of the physicians mania, or rather melancholia. And it's from Edward Topsell. I don't know who that is. And it's from the history, i.e., of four-footed beasts. Four being F-O-U-R-E, beast being B-E-A-S-T-E-S. And so it's like this Old English. And I cannot tell you how much more authenticity and credibility it gave to my metaphorical poem. I was just so pleased to see it there. Much better than Horse of a Different Color. And so I'll just read you this poem. It just gave it some gravitas, you know. I thought it did anyway, and I like that Old English. Shadow horse, you dull my daybreak, my pink of morning, lank specter. No carrot, no apple for you. Come down the mudded path to your pickety pen, where yesterlight slithers, goblin dancing. Let me lead you, gray horse. Let me curry your nappy hide of nettles. Your glassy eye reflects sunrise, ghost of my red shirt. Swivel your ashes of roses ear towards chatter, laughter. Hear me. Hear me. You will not stay. For you are the dam or the filly of the black, vast, opaque. seeking us with hollowed eyes, her bridle rein dragging. Curry comb is just a twisted hanky in my hand. Mm-hmm. Very good, eh? So I just want to thank John for all that, and thank you for your attention to it, and he's going to finish.
Do you guys have 10 more minutes in you? Yeah. Can we just make a sound or a movement for the generous and brilliant Calista?
Yes.
Just like it's a testament to your community that you created this beautiful event. Thank you so much, Cal.
It's the community. This is what they are. Thank you.
I'm going to read a 10-minute poem, and then I'm going to stop abruptly. So this is, let me just create a quick context. This is called The Lighthouse, and this is kind of a parable poem. It's from a perspective of this, like, acolyte, this kind of, like, spiritual seeker, maybe you'd call him, who sees this lighthouse in different parts of the city. It vanishes, it appears somewhere else, and then it vanishes altogether. But it's all from his perspective, and it's a kind of parable city somewhere that never existed. The Lighthouse. 1. The shore shifts, variable, receding, dispersing, toward sea, toward land, toward sky. In the four directions, the shore shifts, dilates, climbs, lopes, shivers. A lighthouse, by its nature, warns against a rocky shore. Sorrowful, pale, spectral lighthouse, immense lighthouse above the city. We citizens below ask, what variable shore in us called out for such a structure of pale sorrow and for such light? Were we out to sea? Where is the land? And, friends, where is the lighthouse? We turned, the lighthouse was gone. Was it blown down? Oh, sentinel, pencil, daffodil, whose color opens outward from the middle. Oh, beacon blazing such a static lavender light yesterday. And then, there it was again. Look, in the main square of the city, our beloved city, no longer on the shore. There, beside you. And you act as if you can't see it. 2. Friends, I am so small compared to you, the very smallest thing in the city. All I see is the lighthouse. It fills my eyes. Under the lighthouse, in the wind, I am most alive, a candle sputtering. All of my laughter, my mirth, a part of it. Just as its light is part of the stars, though not a reflection of them. The lighthouse emanates its own light. See how the sky around it glows lavender at dusk. In truth, between you and me, I don't see the lighthouse anymore either. We all knew it was there until we didn't. Then it was gone 100 years. Nobody, not even fanatics, lunatics, politicians, saw it. At a certain point, to see the lighthouse was a miracle. To this hour, women in rags, frail as damselflies, walk the city blocks, seeking the lighthouse, whispering, "I am the bride, I am the bride of the lighthouse." It became a superstition, a tourist ploy. We sold pewter lighthouses, keychain lighthouses, grandfather clock lighthouses. We sold a paper lighthouse called the Ghost Pharos, to set a flame at your wake to assure a lighthouse in the afterlife. Until, pondering the lighthouse, a huge tiredness came over you. As when you hold a sparrow in your mouth that still sings, but less, less. Then the sparrow, still in your mouth, does not sing for a century. 3. The groom waits at the altar, they prophesied. The teacher is nigh, they assured us. And lo, there it was again, miracle tower, lodestar, lighthouse. Had it been laid low by a gale? Who rebuilt it? No one asked. We were happy. We danced, sang, hands in the air. At night, still the shore shifts. Look, there, a woman climbing the lighthouse. She yells down to us a warning or curse, then plunges upon the jagged sea wall. I collect her body, offer it to the lighthouse. Melancholy and joyous, I suddenly know my place. Friends, I, lowly lighthead, am the one creature qualified to observe with certainty how beautiful you are. You who lean over this poem, craving the dim lavender flame. I care about no other thing than to notice you, to see you. I circle the lighthouse, repeating its myriad names in the summer of all dances. I, star blind, heart raw, turn to you, in love with your bioluminescence. Me? The lighthouse tender? Ha! I'm just a bee shouldering my suicide horn among the poppies, unfit to carry the coattails of the groom of the lighthouse. Or, some asked, was the lighthouse ever here? Although none of us had seen it, nor had our grandmother's grandmothers, we formulated a stipulative definition of it, pending approval from city council. Difficult as it is to establish criteria for a miracle, we were confident we'd accomplish the task. Lighthouse, city miracle, stipulative. One, our city, as all cities, is emblematic of a doctrine of salvation manifest in the variable form of a lighthouse. Two, our city incorporates a lighthouse, a feature found in all cities, visible to every citizen, even sightlessly from windowless rooms. Three, our city, as all cities, is itself a lighthouse whose every window glitters lavender. Addendum. The lighthouse, a neck stretching below what head? Addendum. The lighthouse, oh, sublime tree, scattering fruit among us starving birds. Addendum. The lighthouse, a flickering lamp at the bedside of a wounded child. Thence, definition and addenda affixed on a plaque at City Hall, we put the issue of the lighthouse to rest. But still the citizens, bearing torches on the cobblestones, spoke in hushed whispers. The lighthouse, they said, was no warning to avoid the coast, but a siren calling acolytes to run their boats against it, to be drunk and in love with the variable coast, shifting always like a fever dream. We split into two armed factions, butchering one another in the name of, one, the divine lavender that fills its denizens with bliss, two, the peacekeeping lavender mist that immerses its denizens with love. It was a civil war of tremendous violence. Such schisms bring me joy. I relish your struggles to the pith. Five. A rooster wakes me. Look, there. A woman has been dancing all night, in pain, convulsive, below the lighthouse. Her skin emanates lavender light. The lighthouse, a harp, whose oceanic strumming I hear even with hands clasped over my ears, whose light I see, eyes shut. I open my eyes, the lighthouse is gone. Every day it comes and goes. It is not capricious, but Lord knows I am. I don't remember its existence till I see it again and crack into tears. I pace around it, speaking this poem like a headcase. I am foraging for something at the foot of the lighthouse, but what? Among street dogs and weird flowers, and ah. I say to you, who craves, I know, I see you, the lavender flame, as I do. Do you see it? And I clasp the sleeve of your shirt and say, do you see it? But you push past, brusquely. You who are preoccupied with some other lighthouse. Thanks.
Okay. Callie has asked me to moderate a little Q&A, by which I think means I'm going to ask, does anyone have questions for John? And if you do, you can raise your hand, and I will point at you, and you will ask your question, and he will answer it. So, does anyone have a question?
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yes. This is not a question, actually. This is just something out of curiosity.